From the Sky News Centre at 6, a group of prominent experts has demanded a full inquest into the death of Government Weapons Inspector Dr. David Kelly. The Hutton inquiry heard he died of self-inflicted knife wound to the wrist in 2003. Dr. Margaret Bloom is one of the group.
The last government didn't respond in any positive way to numerous requests to look into the death of David Kelly, and the present government has recently expressed the view that it is considering doing so.
On the day, the Defence Secretary's announced plans to cut the spending at the Ministry of Defence. The department has named a soldier who died from his injuries in hospital on Wednesday after a bombing in Afghanistan. Lieutenant John Charles Sanderson of 1st Battalion, the Mercian Regiment, was wounded in an explosion in Helmand Province last month. The deaths of two more soldiers were also announced today. Their families have been informed. The watchdog responsible for ensuring local councils deliver value for money is to be scrapped to save £50 million. The Department of Communities and Local Government has confirmed the Audit Commission will close between 2012 and 2013. The US state of Alabama is suing BP for damages sustained from the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. The state attorney general says they believe the oil companies inflicted catastrophic harm on the state and that they're suing them for the amount it will take to make Alabama whole. The average dress size worn in the UK has gone up. Researchers say it's now a 16, with a quarter of women wearing a size 18 or above. It's another example of Britain's expanding waistline. These women are in no doubt as to why sizes are on the up.
I think it's personal responsibility to, you know, to care about yourself and to look at why we go to extremes like that.
Everywhere you look, you find foods that are not healthy.
I think the food is a lot different to when we were younger.
And Lindsay Lohan's mother has defended her troubled daughter and blamed her jail term on a judge that played hardball. Dina Lohan told a US chat show she didn't think the 24-year-old deserved to go to prison. That's the latest. I'm Kat Higgins.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Get ready for BCFM's Radio Ramadan 2010. Exclusively here on 93.2 FM. We'll be covering all the local Ramadan news and events, broadcasting live from mosques all around Bristol. You'll also be able to hear the Adhan call to prayer five times a day, hear a diverse selection of nasheeds and Quranic recitations. So come, celebrate Ramadan and Eid only on BCFM's very own Radio Ramadan, broadcasting from Monday the 9th of August till Sunday the 12th of September on 93.2 FM.
Bristol Community FM
93.2. Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling, and with animal welfare campaigner Tracy Worcester. Now, we hear what victims believe is the true cause of Gulf War syndrome in a minute, which is still afflicting thousands of servicemen who returned from Kuwait in 1991. We uncover one of Britain's most controversial uses for nuclear waste, turning it into heavy metal armour-piercing uranium shells. Joanne Baker campaigns locally on these radioactive ammunition, and she explains what DU is and why we should be concerned. But first, in the week that's seen bombs falling off from under cars during the Northern Ireland marching season, and in the run-up to more parades this weekend, Drive Time's Richard Cowley follows up on his report last week on the history and extent of the marches, and asks why the Parades Commission seems unable to ban the marches through opposing neighbourhoods that still provoke riots across Northern Ireland despite the peace process.
Since the 19th century, the British and Northern Irish governments suggest that they have attempted to control the parades, which I don't believe. The Orange Order and its parades were initially banned for a period in the 19th century, but that decision was then overturned after a campaign of defiance led by some Protestant called William Johnson Ballykilburg. And over the next 30 years, and this was used many times to ban or reroute nationalist and Republican and some left-wing parades or marches and meetings. So that by the time we arrived in 1951, the government had passed a public order which required parade organisers to give the police significant notice about 2 days of their intention to perhaps reroute parades. The new act was used disproportionately, however, against nationalist parades particularly, although from time to time ministers attempted to stop unionists and groups from parading through predominantly nationalist areas. And we're talking about now the Home Affairs Minister or ministers were often forced to make public apologies for interfering with the unionist parades by unionists, by loyalists, and two of them were in fact moved from their position after banning unionist and loyalist marches. From the late 1960s, the Public Order Act was used against numerous marches and the issue of parading and who was allowed or who was not allowed to march in what specific area became much more critical or crucial. So by the time we got to 1969, the Protestant Apprentice Boys, for example, parade in Derry, that parade led to what is now known as the Battle of the Bogside, considered by many to be the start of the Troubles. And then several month-long bans on parading were made in the early 70s. And although none of these cover the main Protestant parading period, the special powers of the Public Order Acts were modified on several occasions in the 1970s and through to the 80s.
What about any specific areas in Belfast that have historically attracted violent reactions to parade?
Several areas have been the focus of disproportionate amount of conflict during parades, and these include Derry, the Armagh Road in Belfast, and especially the Drumcree area of Portadown. The fact that the Drumcree conflict flared up in the 1970s and the mid-80s, and indeed in the mid-90s, disputes over whether the Orange Order should be allowed to parade through the mainly nationalist areas were often accompanied by significant violence.
So this is nothing new, then, what we've been seeing this year?
Indeed, it seems to be fairly concurrent and is now an accepted tradition. But recently, Gerry Adams, who is now obviously in a better position of authority, and indeed McGuinness and people like that, are beginning to realise that they don't have to tolerate this, and they want parades rerouted significantly.
So it's pretty obvious to me that if there are parades in Drumcree going through nationalist areas, that it's going to spark riots and trouble. So why don't the new government or the Parades Commission stop this?
In 1998, the Parades Commission was set up in an attempt to, in fact, deal with that very question of disputes. The Commission has the power to ban, restrict, reroute, or impose conditions on any parade within Northern Ireland. The Orange Order has nevertheless refused to acknowledge the Commission's authority, although the lodges involved in the Drumcree dispute have recently agreed on principle to negotiate.
Right, so they're negotiating with the Parades Commission rather than obeying its decisions.
Yeah, and specific to that question, I have extracted some comment on that point.
The latest example of the trend of violence happened on the 11th, the 12th and the 13th of July this year. 82 police officers, I believe, were injured in those riots.
Yeah, it's typical of this time of year, the season, the marching season. Police and people expected, I suppose. To give you an idea of the scale of the violence, 100 youths or so, many of them masked, were throwing petrol bombs, stones and bottles during disturbances in particular areas like the Ardoyne. They threw missiles, petrol bombs at police lines, PSNI police lines, and at least one shot was fired. The police nevertheless returned with water cannons and plastic bullets, which are very dangerous things. I've used those at targets, and I've seen the devastating results that they can have. There was a rifle that was discovered as well in the Ardoyne. Commenting on the weapon, Sinn Féin's Gerry Kelly said that the last time anyone had seen or used a rifle or a weapon in a riot was as far back as 1970, so it's quite significant. Gerry Kelly of Sinn Féin was speaking on radio also about Belfast North Queen Street during July the 11th, where three police officers were shot and wounded. And he said that the violence had been basically orchestrated, as far as he could see, by the dissident group known as the Real IRA, which are different from the Provisional IRA. Yeah, there's a lot of violence in Derry Bogside in particular, another well-known area. Some nationalist areas of Belfast and Armagh City, where police officers were pelted with bricks, petrol bombs, as usual, blast bombs, and came under gunfire. Vehicles were turned over, burned. There was hoax devices left in abandoned vehicles. Belfast up a Crumlin Road in the Ardoyne, or close to there, saw some particularly severe rioting.
So has there been any retaliation or response by loyalists to the latest riots?
Yes, that's typically a tit-for-tat type of characteristic we can also expect, and therefore typically the Orange Volunteers have begun to make threats against Catholic-owned property. The Orange Volunteers first emerged as a group during the Drumcree standoff in 98.
Is it time that Westminster acted here on the parade issue?
In my personal opinion, Westminster need to step in fairly urgently and create some efficient legislation that really does bring this to an end. It's really jeopardizing not just people individually. It's a provocative past legacy. It's a tradition that's no longer required either, you know, so it really should come to an end in some way legally. I think we need to lobby Parliament, Westminster in London, and put the question to the government. It is an obvious problem that could affect the peace process for the worse if not dealt with. In fact, Sinn Féin Gerry Adams recently said that he also called on authorities to reroute the Orange Order and reduce them to a smaller number of contentious parades, including the 12th specifically, which is the Battle of the Boyne, that passes through rather often the Ardoyne, that are contentious. Adams also accused Orangemen of continuing to parade along a handful of specific contentious routes. The Orange Order currently hold over 3,000 parades a year. That's 365 days in a year. And then they're managing to parade 3,000 times a year. That means they must be having, you know, at least 7 to 10 marches a day. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's no wonder that the IRA, whether that it's the real IRA, or anybody else of a nationalist disposition, is completely tired of this matter. The Orange Order should reverse their decision that they made recently when they refused to accept the draft proposals for new legislation on parades that was in fact agreed by the governments of Sinn Féin and the DUP. Sinn Féin MLA Dáil Mackay pointed out that sectarian attacks had a long association with Orange marching. It's provocative, it's deliberate. They use it in that sense in the past, don't they, as a military offensive, territorially. And since we are in the peace process now, surely that they should realise that that's no longer necessary.
Now, the Orange Order are actually saying that they're ignoring the authority of Westminster. They're ignoring the authority of the new Stormont Parliament, which has all sides involved. They're also ignoring the authority of the Parades Commission. Who are the Orange Order to just simply ignore all these democratically elected arms of government?
The Orange Order are an incredibly powerful organisation that dates back, as you know, for the last 30 to 40 years and have been integrally involved at white-collar level through the Masonic connections and lodges right through London and the highest realms of the Palace of Westminster. They supersede law as they choose to see fit to. They collude financially amongst themselves. They are sectarian. They run the risk, I'd say, fairly soon of being revealed for their participation in this. That's basically who they are.
That was a former soldier in the Parachute Regiment, Bryn Richard Cowley, there, who served in Northern Ireland in the 1980s, with his report on the failure by the Parades Commission in Northern Ireland to control a small number of contentious marches that are still provoking riots. On the 6th of August 1945, that's 65 years ago last week, the US Air Force dropped the world's first atomic bomb, nicknamed Little Boy, on the densely populated Japanese city of Hiroshima. Nuclear bombs nowadays make Little Boy weapon look rather small, as modern hydrogen bombs can be up to 1,000 times more powerful. And there are grave doubts about whether the bomb needed to be dropped on a city at all. Many, such as Gar Alperovitz, author of the 1995 book entitled The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb and the Architecture of an American Myth, explains that leading US scientists working on the Manhattan Project believed a bomb dropped at sea or away from a city would have brought about a Japanese surrender just as quickly. Gar also points out in the book that the Japanese emperor was trying to negotiate peace at the time. Many see the Hiroshima bomb as a deterrent to Soviet intervention in Europe, or as a live test to assess potential damage to a populated city. There's also strong evidence the enriched uranium used in Fat Man, the second atomic bomb, which was dropped 3 days later on Nagasaki, was actually refined by the Nazis, taken over to the United States and given to the US scientists at Los Alamos. So they had just enough U-235 for a second bomb. 150,000 people were killed by Little Boy in Hiroshima within the first few days of the explosion, and 70,000 by Fat Man in Nagasaki. Right from the start, of the world was lied to, told that Hiroshima was not a city but a military base. Here's Harry Truman announcing the first use of the atom bomb in the world.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemy. And we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
That's Harry Truman speaking back in 1945 about the very first use of the atomic weapons. Well, Bristol campaigner Joanne Baker joins me now to explain her concerns about one of our armed forces' most controversial weapons, radioactive heavy metal shells made of spent nuclear waste, that is, depleted uranium. Well, hi, Joanne, and welcome to Drive Time.
Okay, hi, thanks.
Now, quite shocking, first of all, that Truman should call Hiroshima a military base.
Yes, precisely. And, you know, just the amount of lies which are being sort of told in our wars. I would like to go back to Truman because I think the interesting thing that we're coming up on now is actually radiation risk, because the types of uranium weapons that are used today, that our governments tell us again and again that they are very low risk. They cannot damage the health of troops. They cannot possibly damage the health of civilians in these countries where they're dropped. But we are working on, the government and all the establishment bodies, including the British Royal Society, are still working on the radiation risk model that was modelled in Japan after Hiroshima. And the science that was done in those days was measuring radiation risk of these huge bombs, which released tremendous amounts of gamma radiation externally to the body. And the radiation risk models were set up at that time in the 1950s. Now, this was a time before we even knew there was such a thing as DNA. And what scientists are coming to now, especially those who work in the biological sciences, are now recognising that the pathways of uranium are very, very different. And this is really the big point of all these arguments today, is whether the weapons which are now being used can affect human health.
And so you've actually written a book, haven't you? Can you just tell us about that? What's the title of it and what's it about?
Yes, the book that I wrote together with...
You've got a copy of it just there. Yeah,
it's called Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq Wars. And we've as much as possible tried to look at the science which Iraqi scientists have done throughout the 1990s, the reports from the doctors and the hospitals, to actually look at what has happened in Iraq over the last 20 years now. And we, you know, that there has been a huge increase in cancers, in birth defects, and these have got a lot worse, of course, since the war of 2003. Which used a great deal more uranium, and we believe in far larger weapon systems. So this is what we're actually looking at today.
So, I mean, can you just explain really what this depleted uranium is? Where does it come from, and how is it used?
Yes, depleted uranium, and in some ways it's a misnomer, because the word depleted seems to imply that it's not very much and that it can't do you much harm. But what happens when they make nuclear power, and there's many nuclear power stations around the world, then they have to enhance the uranium, which means that they use just a tiny fraction of the uranium that's mined, and that's the isotope U-234 and U-235. And the bulk of uranium is then waste, which is the alpha-emitting uranium-238, and this is what is called depleted uranium. So the stockpiles of this, many hundreds of thousands of stockpiles now around the world.
Now, the forces would argue that actually the depleted uranium is actually less radioactive, because they've taken all the really radioactive stuff out to use in the power station.
Yes, there's a fallacy here, because what we're told by the governments and by the army is that it's much less radioactive than the natural uranium that we have in our water and in our soil. And it's true that we have uranium everywhere on the planet. It's a very vital component. It's the great radioactive centre of our planet, which keeps us all warm. But it's very, very diluted in water and rocks. And our bodies over thousands of years have got quite used to it. It's soluble, it just passes straight through us, and it does very little damage to the human body. Now, the uranium, which is used for the enhancement process, that has become very, very concentrated, probably like 30,000 times more concentrate than the uranium that we find in our soil. And so depleted uranium is a little bit more depleted than the very concentrated uranium which is used in nuclear power.
Okay.
So it's not depleted compared to the uranium we actually found in nature.
So now we know where it comes from. How is it actually used in a depleted uranium shell?
Well, it's made into metal, and it has many uses. It's used not only for the military, it's used in civilian uses in hospitals as radiation screens. It's been used as ballast in boats. It's been used in airplanes and all kinds of uses. And in its solid state, it's not very harmful. As I say, it sort of emits alpha radiation. So if I had a lump in front of me here, it wouldn't penetrate my skin at all, so it would actually be quite safe. And so the government in that sense is right. You know, if you have a lump of uranium in front of you, it's not actually going to do you any harm. But when it's used for the military, where it does become very dangerous, it's when it impacts. The point of using uranium is that it's a very, very dense metal, so they only have to use very small amounts of it.
Well, it's much heavier than a conventional bullet or a shell.
Yes,
yeah.
It's very heavy. It's the same weight as tungsten, so it's used fairly interchangeably with tungsten, but it has other properties. One is it's paraphoric, which means that it burns spontaneously when it impacts a hard target. So if you want to hit something and incinerate it at the same time, then you would use DU. If you wanted to just hit it and burst through it, you would use tungsten. It also self-sharpens, whereas tungsten becomes more sort of mushroom shaped. So it's very good to use in shape-charged warheads and things like that, where you actually really need a hard penetrating force. So that's why it's used. And of course, it's relatively cheap because it is a waste product.
In fact, companies are paid quite a lot of money to get rid of it, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay, so what actually happens then with the shell once it hits the target?
Yes, once it hits a hard target, it will burn at very, very high temperatures. It burns at 5,000 degrees centigrade, and this produces very fine dust, minute particles that are completely invisible. And that have become ceramic, so it's no longer the soluble uranium that we drink in our water. It's become ceramic. So you can breathe, and they're so minute, they're very easy to breathe in. You can breathe it in through your nose. It gets into the food chain, it can be ingested. And it's that uranium, when it gets inside the body, that causes the damage. Because even the smallest particle will sort of latch onto your DNA, for example, and then start causing all kinds of problems. It will stay in the body for years and years, and it will just zap away.
So how,
and it's that zapping away which causes mutation and cancers.
Okay,
and,
so can yeah. you just take us through some of the long-term effects for people that do have a bit of this depleted uranium that attached itself to their DNA? Mm. What effect does it have?
Yeah, well, what they found in countries where it's been used, in the Balkans and in Iraq, Afghanistan, that there's been a huge increase in childhood leukemias, in all kinds of cancers, including very whole change in the pattern of cancer in those countries. Some very rare cancers, sometimes several different types of cancer in one person. Horrendous birth deformities. The birth deformities haven't been seen like that, for many. They're quite similar to the ones experienced on the Pacific Islands during the atomic tests. And It's become absolutely terrifying for women in those countries. I've talked to people in Iraq, who young women who are so scared to give birth. And I think anyone, you know, when you are pregnant, you just, the one prayer is that your child will be healthy and it won't have these problems. And, you know, they're really awful deformities. Children being born with two heads or with no head, all kinds of eye deformities. The cyclops syndrome, where the child just has one eye in the middle of the head. Sometimes they're just sort of blobs of jelly-like substance, which doesn't look anything like human. And so it's very, very traumatic.
Now, what about, is there really any evidence that this really is DU that's causing this?
Well, the only evidence we have is that this is occurring in areas where DU has been used. In 1991, it was particularly around Basra, where we knew it was being used, but it was also in other parts, because in Mosul and Baghdad and Babylon, many parts of Iraq had actually suffered these types of weapons throughout the 90s. 2003, there's been a very recent survey done by Chris Busby in Fallujah. And again, you know, he's not saying it's only uranium, because all kinds of things, including white phosphorus, were actually used there. But
now, hang on, I know Chris Busby. He runs something called the Low Level Radiation Campaign, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's the one who's actually working on the new risk model through the European Committee for Radiation Risk, where many scientists are looking at what the actual risk is to uranium when it gets inside the body. Yes, and he found in this recent survey, he found very high levels of birth defects, of cancers in young children, and many other types of illnesses. And also what was very interesting was the male-female sex ratio, which is exactly what happened in Japan after Hiroshima, that there are far fewer boys, 80% fewer boy births in Fallujah now than girls. And it's because the male only has one X chromosome, and it's evidently a lot more sensitive to this type of mutation. So this has also just come up.
Now, these weapons, are they actually legal? Is they perfectly legal to use? Is there any law that sort of says that you should use one type of weapon and not another one?
Well, the government will say that they are legal. Many environmental lawyers are saying that they aren't, because they don't pass the test in that they are a long-term environmental risk. Therefore, they shouldn't be legal. But as yet, we haven't got that through the international courts. It has been the European Union, Parliament, they've passed several resolutions now to actually make it illegal. And it's also been brought up in the UN. So there is a move to make these types of weapons illegal. But the problem with this is that at the moment, they're just talking about the anti-tank penetrators and the things which we actually know about and which Britain and America have admitted to. But the fear now is that uranium is actually going into much larger weapon systems.
Now, don't you think that our soldiers, when they're off fighting abroad, really need to have the best, you know, equipment to, you know, if there's a foreign tank coming towards them, they really want to fire something that they think is actually going to work?
Yes, true. But then this is very double-edged in a way. I mean, for one thing, these types of weapons, they were created during the 70s, during the Cold War, to use against very heavy fortified Soviet armour. And most of our wars going on at the moment don't really have that type of risk. And the other thing is that, yes, they may save lives on the battlefield, if you want to put it like that, But this dust is just as much a danger to the health of the soldiers as it is to people who actually live in the area. And it's now believed that it could be largely responsible for what has become known as scarf wall syndrome. And also during the Balkans, there were many deaths amongst the peacekeepers who were stationed in Kosovo after the bombings in Italy, Portugal and Spain, there were quite a few soldiers died of very rapid onset cancers, leukemias, things that were going on then. So maybe it saves them on the battlefield, but if it's going to cause extreme long-term health effects for them, then, you know, that is not so good. And also, one soldier in America, he was saying, you know, because they are also having children with birth deformities. And I remember hearing a soldier saying, you know, I joined the army and I was ready to risk my life for my country, but it's something completely else if I'm risking the health and well-being of my children. You know, that is something else that actually quite a lot of the troops are very concerned about.
Well, back to Joanne in a minute, but with over 2,000 sufferers still, what was Gulf War syndrome really all about? Was it all in the mind, as the Ministry of Defence told the press back in 1991 and 92? One man who ought to know suffered very badly out in Kuwait in the first Gulf War, and the syndrome has stayed with him ever since. He's a founder of the former chairman of the Gulf War Veterans and Families Association and a fully trained army medic. Tony Flint gives us his conclusions.
Now, so many of us were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. That's what they're saying, but through American research, what we've found out is the anti-nerve agent tablets they were giving us, we used to call them NAPs, they used to call them PB tablets. The main constituent in it is pyrostigmine bromide. What this drug has done, it's damaged and killed off brain cells, which affect our emotions, muscular movement, has caused a certain amount of nerve damage as well. But it gives the same outward signs as post-traumatic stress. It's not caused through trauma, like post-traumatic stress is associated with, but it's caused through taking these tablets, which has killed off brain cells. It's more physical than really mental.
Right.
Well, these tablets we had to take three times a day for all the time that we was out there. They were having side effects on us, and which was mainly diarrhea for all of us. The typical thing that was said, if you weren't in your section and a mate comes looking round for you, they just turn around and say, oh, it's the naps, and I knew to find you in the toilet. We had loads of injections given to us during a period of a month, but with our unit, they was only given on three separate days. On the 27th of December 1990, I was given cholera, tetanus, typhoid, hepatitis B and polio, all at the same time. That was when I was first called up. That night I'd come home and I had a terrific fever all night long, you know, which obviously was through having so much serum pumped in my body at once. My body just couldn't cope with it. A week later, on the 4th of January 91, I was given yellow fever, meningitis, anthrax, and pertussis, which is the whooping cough vaccine. They said that was an adjuvant to try and boost up the effects of the anthrax vaccine. A couple of weeks later, on the 28th of January, I was given a second anthrax, a second pertussis vaccine, and the plague vaccine. What I learned later through my research, and it is in an official MOD report, is that they were so worried about the side effects of the plague vaccine that they gave it to our unit first to see how many of us would become ill. All of us got flu-like symptoms. Some of the guys and the women were actually that bad, they had to be bedded down with these flu-like symptoms, which lasted for about a week. But ever since then, every 6 to 8 weeks, I still get a dose of flu.
And what about depleted uranium? Because there's a lot of evidence that depleted uranium was used by the Allies, both the Americans and the British, in the Gulf War.
yeah, it wasn't until we came back here that people started getting these cancers. A lot of our veterans that were having children were having very severe birth defects, because what depleted uranium does, if it gets into your system, it can get into the reproductive system. Then obviously you pass it on to your families. Even in my own case, not long after I come back, my wife started getting a lot of infections down below, and they were very painful. And one time it got that bad that she went up to the local casualty on a Sunday. The doctor says, well, I don't really know what's causing all this. And then my wife explained that I was a Gulf veteran, and says, well, I don't know what it is, but don't dare have any children, which, you know, we weren't planning on doing anyway. But, you know, I've passed infections on to her, which makes me feel a damn sight worse than, you know, being ill myself. You know, I was the one who signed on the dotted line. So I expect, you know, what happens to me, although I'm not very happy because it's been done by my own side. But to, you know, pass these illnesses onto my wife, you know, I think is right out of order. And the depleted uranium, what I found out, that I've got a small amount of uranium or depleted uranium in my right kidney, which does affect my going to the toilet. You know, I've got to make sure I know where a toilet is straight away. And I know a lot of other guys that have developed cancers in various parts of their body, because what we didn't realise at the time of the Gulf War, we was handling casualties coming back from the front line. Depleted uranium, after the weapon goes off, becomes a very, very fine dust, and you only need a hundredth of a gram to get into your body to cause these kind of effects. This dust was flying about everywhere, burnt out tanks and vehicles, being blown about by the wind everywhere. And once a casualty was brought back, obviously he still had his clothes on, covered in dust and sand and whatever. We was bringing him back, undressing him, treating him. So we was disturbing this dust and breathing it in. Me not being on the front line, that is the way that I believe that, you know, I've got the stuff inside of me.
It seems a bit unfair, really, for someone that's gone out to serve their country to then find that actually that the horrendous after effects have actually been caused by their own side.
Well, that's what really upsets me. You know, I'm a combat medic, and I know from statistics that for casualty rates, you know, when you go into a war zone, you know, quite possibly you're not going to come out again, but you accept that. You know, that is part of your job. But to, you know, be made ill by your own side is just not on.
If you blame anybody, who do you blame for this?
Well, the MOD for not doing their research properly. Because all these weapons, all these vaccines should have been tested. We was going in, so they said, to something that had never been done before, possibly a chemical war. But there was, during the First World War, they used chemicals, and they experimented with them during World War II. And even when I was a regular soldier between 1964 and 1974, we was training for chemical and biological warfare. So why hadn't the MOD, the Army, Porton Down, the main chemical and biological research centre for the Ministry of Defence, chemical and biological warfare stuff. So since 1964, they could have been working out some sort of system that could have been given to us that was safe. And, you know, you're talking Gulf War 1991, so you're talking on nigh on 30 years. But no, nothing was done whatsoever to try and protect us.
How does this all make you feel about the way you were treated by the Army and by the Ministry of Defence?
Well, it makes me very, very angry. And to hear and knowing my mates are dying off since coming back, you know, when we was out in the Gulf, we lost 45 guys, which is damn good casualty figures for any campaign. But, you know, since coming back, at one stage, I worked out our death rate has been nearly 2 a month. And you're talking on guys in their early 20s going up to sort of mid-40s then. And, you know, I know of guys that are still dying because of their suffering from the first Gulf War.
And finally then, have you got a message for youngsters thinking of joining up now?
Well, I would say, you know, it's an honour to serve your country, and you'll never get better friends than you'll get in the Army. We live for each other, but if anything does happen to you, you're going to be on your own once you come out. You've only got your family to rely on, because the MOD and the Army just will not help.
Well, that was the founder and former chairman of the Gulf War Veterans and Families Association, fully trained Army medic, Tony Flint.
I'd like to follow up what Tony was saying, because he was talking about what happened in 1991, and then we saw in the following decade, we saw all the illnesses suffered by the troops. We saw, you know, all the birth defects and the cancers, things happening in Iraq. And you would have thought it would have just allowed them to pause a minute and say, is there any substance in this? You know, is DU really safe? Maybe we should do some more tests. Maybe we should think about it again. And so from that, we came up to, it was used again in the Balkans, of course, and then in Afghanistan, and then to the 2003 Iraq War. And instead of scaling down the use of DU, it was actually upped. And it was used not only against sort of tanks, but it was used everywhere. It was used against buildings, houses, just ordinary cars. It was used in all the towns and villages throughout Iraq. And that was the huge difference between the 2003 invasion and the 1991 war, was that it was used just absolutely everywhere. I went to Basra in 2004, and I was taken by a local scientist who was working entirely on his own. And he'd just been going around Basra trying to find the hot spots. And he'd come across a suburban area. It was just like a large square with houses all the way around it. And he introduced me to this family. What had happened there was that in March 2003, some Iraqi personnel carriers had been just passing through this area, and one of them had broken down. And then they called for the other one just to come and help them, to get them sort of going again. And at that point, an American 18 aircraft spotted them, came overhead, and just sprayed them with depleted uranium shells, which vehicles and any troops inside them were completely incinerated. And it also hit a nearby house, because it was just on the street outside some houses. And two of the boys who actually lived in that house, they were just going home at that stage. They were like 17 and 18. And they were killed outright. A young cousin who was nearby, he sustained some very severe burns. And one of the rooms in the house was completely demolished. Now, when I went there in 2004, which was over a year after this, the family of eight children were still living in what remained of their house. We were very, very poor people. The scientist who showed me, he'd just been around, as soon as he found it, he actually donned his radiation gear and tried as best he could just to clean up some of the dust. But this family was still living in that house. Some of the girls have started to have very bad skin problems. One of the younger boys was losing his night vision. And outside, these two troop carriers, they were still outside, the sort of burnt out shells. And all the local children, you know, they were just playing around. They were probably like building houses in the mall, whatever kids do, running around in bare feet in this dust. And no one had been to warn them. There were no notices put out. No one said anything. So as I was in Basra, I went to the British Army, which were actually based there, and I told them the story and said that this really, really needed to be cleared up. The scientists had also approached them. He'd also approached the World Health Organization, and they both, I mean, there had been no help at all. In the end, I heard some, about a year or so later, the army did actually move it, but it just dragged the shells a few hundred yards up the road and dumped them again. So there were now two spots that were at, you know, that were actually showing quite high levels of radiation. And the family, to this day, this family is still living in that home. And they say it's not their business. It's the responsibility of the Iraqi government to clear up anything after war, you know, to rehouse these people. But Iraq is not in a state to do any of these things. It hasn't even got a proper government, you know, and these people are just being left. And again, when questions like this were put to Parliament, we were told again and again that everyone was being warned that all this stuff was being cleared up, and it wasn't. I mean, and still in sort of south of Basra, there was a very large tank battle, and all those bits of scrap metal are still there. People are using them to sell on. Their cows and their sheep are still grazing all around there. And, you know, all this radiation, you know, is in the soil and the plants and everywhere else. Yeah.
Now, believe it or not, there is actually a song being written about depleted uranium. And you've brought it along with you today. Do you want to just introduce it, Jo?
Yes, this was written by Rita Lynch, who's a local Bristol singer and songwriter. And she wrote this after hearing quite a lot about DU and what was actually happening to the troops and also to people in Iraq. So this was her response.
Caught by the hour, crawling
Local artist Rita Lynch from her CD called What Am I, with a great big picture of her with her hands, actually a fist up in the air. Great stuff. Anyway, I think we should be hearing a bit more of that on the other local radio stations, really, shouldn't we? And I'm joined in the studio by Joanne Baker, who's a campaigner on depleted uranium. Now, Jo, can I just ask you to remind us about your book? It's called Uranium in Iraq, isn't it?
Yes, Uranium in Iraq, poisonous legacy of the Iraq wars, and it was written really as a response to what has happened in Iraq since the first use of DU in 1991.
Okay, now also there are other weapons, you think, aren't there, that involve something that you think is a secret? So can you just reveal all those secrets to us now?
Yes, right. There's some very interesting things going on that we don't really fully know all about.
And one thing I will say, yes, is that quite often the military like to have these weapons kind of up their sleeve, don't they? For decades without ever even acknowledging that they exist.
Yes, and I think it was because there was so much fuss was being made over DU, especially amongst the troops. But what has been discovered is patents, US patents, going back to the 1980s to use depleted uranium or uranium in much larger weapon systems. For example, there's one here, December the 11th, 1997, US patent 6389977 proposes a shrouded aerial bomb, BLU-109B, wherein the penetrating body is formed of depleted uranium. And there's many, many of these. Now, Jane's Information Group website, which is all about what's happening in the arms industry, that's also said that DU has been used to increase the penetration effect of guided weapons and shaped charge warheads. The MOD website some years ago had about tests. It was a joint French-Anglo test of DU liners in shaped charge warheads that were being tested at Eskimos and also at Aldermaston. In 2003, Jay Shaft, a US journalist, interviewed a US Special Operations Command colonel who didn't give his name, but he acknowledged that the GBU-28 BLU-113 penetrator bunker buster 5,000-pound bomb contained DU in its warhead. And this story goes on and on.
Well, the interesting thing about this, of course, is that the enemy, a potential enemy, can go and have a look at these patents. So really the secrecy is just trying to keep this out of the public domain and keep it away from the soldiers and keep it away from us.
Yes, and also the public health, because what has happened is that after these wars in the Balkans, Afghanistan, what happened after Chernobyl actually was that many, many countries started using air filters to find out how much uranium was in the air. Now, it's these in the Balkans after the 1999 bombings. It came up very strongly in Macedonia and in southern Hungary. Chris Busby had an interesting one in Aldermaston. He discovered that in 2003, there was a high peak in uranium after the shock and awe bombing in Baghdad, and that where the wings, because they can now trace, NOAA traces all the wind movements from Baghdad to Britain. So maybe there's a lot of this stuff moving around in the air that is coming back to us.
Now, very quickly, and to sort of round off, really, now Sky TV, I mean, we're talking about this as rather secret, but Sky TV actually covered it, didn't they?
What they covered was the birth defects in Fallujah, but it was quite horrendous viewing, but they only mentioned white phosphorus. Nobody mentioned uranium, but the birth defects they were showing were identical to the ones that were found in Basra after 1991.
Okay, now one TV journalist and commentator that's been making award-winning documentaries at ITV for several decades, which are critical of British and American foreign interventions, bringing pictures of the devastation we and our allies wreak in our into our living rooms, not actually wreaking it in our living rooms, but they're bringing it in there, is John Pilger. There is a whispering campaign at the BBC against him, but he does appear on English-language Russian channel Russia Today. Here he is recently talking there about US President Barack Obama's announcement 2 weeks ago that we're at last seeing the end of the US intervention in Iraq.
We live in an age of what they call in Washington perpetual war, and I'm quoting General Petraeus, permanent war. That's not progress, that's regression, and that we have to deal with. I mean, this announcement by Obama that would be the end of the combat mission next year is nonsense. And that's another example of the media simply taking at face value something they're told by authority. In fact, there's going to be something like 94 bases left and 60,000 troops and a surge, so-called, that is an increase in the number of mercenaries. They call them contractors. So far from getting out, it's consolidating its position in Iraq. And that's what people really should understand. There was a great expression by a great Irish investigative journalist called Claude Coben, never believe anything until it's officially denied. We should apply that to all statements like that. And the paradigm hasn't changed since 1945. American foreign policy runs in a straight line. That trajectory runs unerringly in one direction. What Obama has done is simply pick up all the policies of Bush and pursue them. I mean, for example, for the first time in US presidential history, and hasn't happened before, a president has taken the entire Defense Department bureaucracy and the Secretary of State for Defense from a previous administration, a discredited one. So we have basically Robert Gates and the same generals running American foreign policy. Another war has really begun in Pakistan, also in Yemen and Somalia, with other interests in Africa. Obama has accelerated Bush's policies.
That was Australian and British journalist John Pilger. And finally, Joanne Baker, author of Uranium in Iraq. If you want to find it on the internet, you can buy it on Amazon and all other good websites. Can you just tell us very briefly what you're doing next?
Right. What I'm hoping to do next is to set up a peace project which really looks at human security, taking away security away from the military and actually looking at what people, individuals need in terms of security. And this brings it right into, the fears of climate change and all these things, because what's happening at the moment is that so many of our resources, financial resources, intellectual resources, are being zapped away into these huge military projects, into the arms trade, into places where we don't really need it. And Bristol, remember, has a huge arms trade here. We need to convert those jobs and bring them back to something that is good for the earth, good for the environment, and good for us all, and good for our future children.
Lovely, Joe. Thanks very much. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. And Radio Ramadan. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you've got a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or want to suggest a guest for a future show, go to www.thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, And that was a candidate for the Unite Union's leadership and Bristol trade unionist Jerry Hicks. Thanks also to Marina Morris and ethical farming campaigner Tracy Worcester, and to Richard Cowley for his report on the Northern Ireland Orange Marches, and Joe Baker, anti-DU campaigner. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday Drive times on www.thisweek.org.uk, and this show is usually uploaded by about midnight. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Is the community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.